Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
I demand the cone of silence.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm at the controls, Al Warren. Now, it's a full house today, but everybody is social distancing. We got John Copenhaver. I can't say your name anymore.
Hey, Al.
We got John, okay? And I'm going to get our announcer to say it now. Like, that's who you like, the new announcer, so she can do it.
Yeah, she says it. She says it nicely.
Yeah.
She does a good job.
I can't. I don't know. She's only been on the radio 20 years. I can't say anything. I'm just. And then, of course, we've got making the drinks, the cocktails, the one that needs a new door carpet, David North Martino. That was disgusting.
Present.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
I am. I'm absolutely ashamed.
I'm going to put that all over the internet, you know.
Yeah.
That's right. Everyone's going to see that. Looks like a dog ate his front door now.
Oh, boy.
My God, it's embarrassing.
It really is.
Yeah. So you're going, it's terrible. You're going to be doing the dishes next. Now, today we've got a special guest. We've got a New York Times best-selling author, and she's got a newer book out. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk a little bit about her work beforehand and all sorts of things. So Alma Katsu, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So you're awake now. So you had, we don't have to get into the details too much, but you've had a history as working for the CIA. And
I had a history. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. It was, over 30 years in the intelligence business, not only CIA, but NSA, too, which will probably make half your listeners turn off.
I'll get 400 hate mails, you know, working for MK Ultra and all that sort of stuff. We're paid. But you got into that. You did that for 30 years. So after you've left the agency, you've gotten into writing, and that's quite a change. And I noticed primarily you were writing more of a horror fiction style of writing. What was that transition for you? Like, how did it go from CIA to horror fiction?
Well, I'll tell you, it's even messier than that, because part of the reason why I just had my first spy novel come out this year is because I only retired a few years ago. I'd actually been writing the other novels. I had 5 novels before Red Widow while I was still working. I sold my first book at 50 as I was starting to look at the end of the career. But, it's really hard to write an espionage novel while you're still in the business. And so, you know, I think that's part of the reason why I just sort of avoided it. But once I retired, I was talking to my editor at Putnam, and she really encouraged me to go for it. It's something I'd always wanted to do, but wasn't quite sure actually that I could do it. So,
was it that you weren't sure of? Was it the actual writing skills itself, or was it just the storyline? Like, what was it that gave you hesitation?
Well, you know, so it's a complicated relationship, I think, between writing about a profession when you're in the profession. And I'm sure it applies to a lot of professions, but for intelligence in particular, you know, one of the things that it never sat right with me and doesn't sit right with a lot of my friends in the business is, you know, sort of the way that we're portrayed. And as a writer, I understand why. It's, you know, because books have to have drama and they have to follow, you know, a certain arc that people sort of expect. And, you know, it can't be too fussy or hard to follow or that sort of thing. But those are all sort of baked into the intelligence work. You know, I tell people, if you look at the typical scope of a spy novel, you know, it's usually a lone hero, right? Oftentimes a brooder or an outsider or something who, you know, no one else can do this. He's got to be the one that's going to take down the villain. And so, you know, you're barreling through all of these twists and turns to get, you know, and then it's like a wrestling match at the end with between the, you know, the antagonist and the protagonist, and he's like throwing the person up against the wall and taking the bomb and throwing it out the window and narrowly averting disaster. And in the real life, we would call that an intelligence failure because you want to avoid getting to that, you know, sort of court of last resort, so to speak, you know, or a situation where only one person can save the day. If you do it right, you know, you're coming up with a plan that, you know, people will never know there was, you know, some kind of horrible disaster that we averted. And so anyway, I just, you know, when you're a professional and you have a lot of pride in your work, it just, you know, kind of rubs you the wrong way to think that that's how I'm going to have to portray it for the public. So it took me a long while to come up with an idea for a story that I thought would do both, that would both be sort of true to what the job's like for professionals, but also would sort of meet the expectation of modern audiences.
So you're telling me that the 30 years that you're in with the intelligence agencies, you didn't look like Angelina Jolie running around with big heels?
God, I wish I looked like
and karate chopping everyone. Like
I gave up big heels a long time ago. Towards the end, I think about an inch and a half was all I could handle.
Well, it's kind of funny. So I think that's really a key point there for me, especially when you say how the CIA, for instance, or NSA or any of the groups are portrayed in movies. They're always looked at as, you know, godlike, you know, James Bond sort of characters. They can do anything. So that's, I guess there's quite an exaggeration. Do you think anybody out there kind of displays what the CIA agents really look like?
Oh, well, that's interesting. I mean, you know, there's one of the things that happened with Red Widow is we actually did, you know, Fox picked it up for a TV series. So I was told to look at all of the, you know, more contemporary, you know, spy shows and stuff on TV so I could tell producers what worked and what didn't work, because I kind of avoided them to a degree. I think in a lot of folks in the business, you know, they either watch these types of things and they sort of, you know, just enjoy them for what it's worth, or they avoid them. I was one of the avoiders. So there have been a few shows recently that have been pretty good. The Americans is excellent, by the way. And Joe Weisberg did a brilliant thing in setting it back in the 80s, because that freed him up from worrying about, you know, getting on the wrong side of pre-publication review, you know, by trying to reveal too much. So he was actually able to be very true to what the tradecraft was like back then, and, you know, what the job was like without, you know, running into trouble. And it's not so changed from today. I mean, the technology certainly has changed, but sort of the basics of tradecraft, you know, trying not to get caught. You know, disguises are not like Mission Impossible. They're more like The Americans, you know, where you're just trying to get past, you know, the more casual observer, you know, although that's changing a little bit with facial recognition technology and that sort of thing. So, yeah, there's a few things out there that are a bit more true to life. When you said what CIA officers look like, it kind of threw me for a minute, because I used to joke around at the agency, you know, having grown up at NSA where they're all nerds and dweebs, that by comparison, they hire attractive people at CIA because, you know, you generally will tell attractive people more than you'll tell, you know, you'll trust them, you'll relax around them a little bit more than you will around unattractive people.
Yeah, well, no, that's true. Yeah. I mean, they've been after me to work for them for years.
I'm surprised that you're not, really.
Yeah, well, too much of a bad history, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. Something about me, you know. I noticed that you have a Russia theme to this book. Is that still kind of the enemy, so to speak?
Well, you know, it might depend on who you ask. You know, America has a lot of adversaries out there. Yeah. And I'm not a Russian expert, which surprises some people. My, you know, my career was divided up over two things. One, and this will just put all of your listeners right to sleep. The last 12 years or so has been in emerging technologies. But before that, I did what's known as complex contingency operations. We won't go into that, but it's basically multilateral affairs. And so, you know, I was always brushing up against Russians, you know, Russian foreign policy and defense policy and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I was just familiar enough with it. But I'm going to go back to that emerging technologies part, because most of the technical work I did had to do with social media research. So I've been working with a lot of top researchers looking at disinformation campaigns for a long time. And so I'm here to tell you, yes, Russia is still a pretty substantial enemy.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. But there must be a line. That's what this, I don't know, you tell me, wouldn't it be the hardest thing to really tell us what's going on, so to speak? I mean, because when you're writing a book like this, and you've got Russia involved, and you got, you know, CIA involved, you got all this stuff going on. How truthful can you be?
I guess it depends on, you know, like all tradecraft is a little sleight of hand, right? What you want to reveal and what you want to hide. And so if you're good, you can make the stuff you reveal like so distracting that people might not notice the things you're hiding. So, you know, I think what you're referring to are sources and methods. Those are the things that any intelligence agency protects the most, right? And if you've been given access to them, like people with security clearances do, you know, you're not allowed to disclose any classified sources or methods. And those are the things that people think they want to learn. But I think, at least in my limited experience so far, I think they're happy enough just sort of setting the scene and sort of providing glimpses into how it works. But, you know, spy novels, like any story, you know, they're really very character-based. And I think if you provide, you know, a really satisfying character-driven story, that's what most people are looking for, with a little embellishment of, you know, what the, you know, little taste of what the tradecraft's like. Or, you know, what I really try to provide is a lot of a bigger taste of what the culture is really like, what it's like to really do the job, as opposed to the technical parts of it.
Did you have to get...
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Did you have to get Red Widow cleared by the CIA or NSA before you could have it published?
By CIA, yes. Luckily, a few years back, the agencies did a very humane thing where they decided that if you're one of the oddballs like me who worked for more than one agency, you wouldn't have to have your work cleared by every single agency. You could turn it into one. And they were supposed to look for the equities of the other agencies. Now, whether they do or not, I have no idea. CIA, I handed it into CIA because obviously it's about CIA. And it was up to them to look out for NSA equities. So it did go into the pre-publication office for review. And I'm really happy and amazed to say that they asked for no changes to the manuscript. And in my experience, this is like how tightly they restrict things. It swings back and forth on a pendulum. Like sometimes they're crazy. Like they won't let you use terms that are in very, very wide use, you know, popular usage. And other times, like now, that they seem to have a more realistic outlook on what they, I guess maybe because so many books now, nonfiction books, have been put out by former agency employees and other folks from elsewhere in the intelligence community too, that there's just so much more knowledge out there right now. I'm reading a book called Damascus Station, which was written by a CIA analyst, Dave McCloskey. And it's coming out in October, I think. And he was a Syrian analyst. And I am amazed at what they let him put in the book. Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I really loved about Red Widow was that you made women really central to the story. I mean, your protagonists, I guess you have two of them, are really, you know, the drivers of the story. Was that a conscious choice on your part? Or, I mean, I haven't read much of that in spy fiction before, so I'm just curious about those choices.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the things that I'd always found a little dissatisfying about a lot of spy fiction. Because even though there certainly are men in the business, there's a lot of women too. I mean, I can't give you exact numbers, but in my experience, we're about half. And half in everything, you know, case officers, technical officers, managers. And, you know, there's been, I've worked with a lot of really, really competent, fine, outstanding women in every field. And yet we weren't seeing ourselves being represented in the popular culture so much. It seemed very male-centered. And while that's not bad, I just thought it was owed to women to see ourselves being represented accurately in something. And I have to say the response, I really didn't expect this kind of response. I thought it would be very dismissed as, you know, not real spy fiction, because it wasn't doing the things that, you know, James Bond or a Jason Bourne, you know, Ted Cruz's favorite CIA agent. I can't believe he said that today.
We live in a weird world.
But that kind of goes to the point, right? Then when people think of intelligence professional, that's what they think of. I'm sorry to tell you. That actually is not what goes on in the intelligence business.
You mean they all don't look like Jason Bourne?
Right. They're not all superhuman assassins who do parkour. I mean, you know, it's just, honestly, well, was that the best we could do?
Yeah, I'm disappointed. I thought, well, somebody's got to make the coffee in the office, right? So
there's a lot of that going on. I had to laugh about it. I was going through the book, you know, after it was put to bed and, you know, and how much coffee drinking there is. But it's true. And part of the reason is it's one of the few excuses you have to get up and get away from your desk and take a break.
Yeah. It's really a covert operation getting coffee. Hey, so who is Lindsay Duncan, for instance? Like who is that?
Well, you know, that character is sort of based on, you know, a type of officer that I was seeing, you know, especially as I was getting towards retirement age. And, you know, and I had spent a year or two as a recruiter for the agency. And you just see these young women who come in who are extremely bright and their heart's in the right place and they're very patriotic and they just want to do the best job they can. And, you know, maybe they don't see the pitfalls in the office, you know, until they get burned a few times. And then they realize, you know, that there's another game going on there that they better learn to play. You know, they're a little idealistic when they first go in. You know, so people have asked me, is that me? No, that is not me. I'm the older, bitter person who's been around for a long time and has been burned really bad. Yeah. And
got a grudge.
Wait, yeah. Wait, does that make you Teresa, the Red Widow?
Much more like Teresa. And the other interesting thing is that whole book is actually based on a true case. It's just that it's been changed a lot so that it wouldn't be recognized, because what happened has actually never been publicly associated with the agency, but it is an actually well-known case. and I don't want to give away any spoilers, but the bad guy in it is based on a real person, someone that I know.
Jason Bourne.
Interesting.
He wishes he were Jason Bourne.
I tell you. Well, it's really interesting. So, being an ex-agent, with the last years, especially the last 4 or 5 years, and the climate in the political world, let's just say, or even in the country in common about agencies, you know, CIA, FBI, and all that, it's been kind of a little bit more negative than probably definitely should be. Has that affected your life?
Well, it's interesting, right? I mean, if you look back at the things that a lot of senior intelligence folks who were also retired or, you know, whatever, did during the last administration, like the number of times they signed their names to statements, you know, sort of decrying what was happening, you know, gives you an example, just, you know, kind of points out how extraordinarily weird that time was. In some ways, I was happy to be out of the business because my head would have exploded. I mean, you know, especially when you get kind of towards the end of your career and you've been through this a little bit, you understand, you know, that, you know, when you take the job, you, if you didn't know it going in, you're acclimated to it very soon. You know, we serve people in the intelligence business, serve the American people, right? But the American people tell us what they want through the people they elect. And so when you're in the situation that we had in the last administration, you know, you're really in this bind. I'm sure there were people in the intelligence community that helped the information that would have, you know, blown a lot of the bullshit right out of the water. But you can't just give it away to the public, right? There are channels you go through, but, you know, there's a lot of constraints on that too. At the end of the day, the agencies themselves have to come to a determination of what's legal and proper. And, you know, there's a reason why certain secrets never get out. But anyway, you know, I'm sure people who were still working at the time were really just finding themselves in a terrible, terrible bind. So for me, in some ways, it was better. I still have a clearance because I'm still a consultant back to the government. And so I was finding myself biting my lip a lot. But now that I'm really close to getting out 100%, I've been a little more free with my criticisms.
Do you ever really get out?
Oh, let's hope so.
In the movies, they never get out.
I've known some people who've ended up in jail. So, you know, you have to really be, you can't get too free, you know, with those secrets.
Well, yeah, I would imagine that. Does that put a little fear in the back of your mind? In day-to-day life? Like
day-to-day life, not so much. Because first of all, I moved away from D.C. and I live on a mountaintop in West Virginia. John knows all about it. So while there are lovely, lovely people out here, I don't feel like, you know, like somebody could sneak up on me or something like that. Although I suppose they could.
Well, John's a Russian asset.
There's only one or two here that I'm so actually unlikely. Concerned about, but
that's confidential.
And I think John knows who I'm talking about, but yeah, no, so not so much. You know, after a while, you kind of know where the line is that you shouldn't be, you know, stepping over. So yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to the day when I'm totally out of it, because then I can smoke pot. I've never smoked pot in my entire life, and I've been sure it's a lot of pot.
Well, it's not that big a deal anyway. But you mean you can't smoke pot? Like, why? I mean, isn't it? I guess it's not legal totally.
It's still not legal. It's still a federal offense. Yeah.
Well, there you go. Well, so how many do you want to make this into a regular? Because you were doing horror fiction, right? And then now you've gone into this kind of spy thriller novel. Is this something you want to continue?
Well, I hope so. We've got the TV show, which is in very active development as we speak. And then I just signed the contract for the second book, Red London, and just started doing the deep research today. Woo, what a pain. But yeah, then there's the historical horror. It's kind of weird. I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen. The next book that will be published with my name on it will be historical horror, and it's The Fervor, and it has to do with the Japanese internment during World War II, which is kind of personal for me because my husband's family was interned, and a lot of my friends' families were interned, and so I know a lot about it, and it certainly is a horrible situation. So that's the next one. But then after that, and then I guess the next Red London is under contract. But then who knows what will happen. I guess it'll just depend on how well things did go.
Yeah, pretty. So who's going to play the character? Is it like Queen Latifah? Or?
You know, I've heard some all kinds of names bannered about. But I guess you don't really know until we're at the pilot stage right now where we're hoping to get the green light to go ahead with the pilot. And then I guess the names really start flying around.
So this is this is taking place in modern times, right?
Yes. Well, fairly modern. Yeah.
Fairly modern. Are you going to bring in modern problems that we've faced as well? You know, like not necessarily Trump, I mean that, but like with the pandemic and things like that, do you incorporate that into your books or do you think you will?
Well, the pandemic, that's a tough one, right? Like if the timeline sort of catches up, I think Red Widow is more or less set in 2018. So yeah, if the timeline catches up, I think that's a question for all writers that we're going to have to think about. It would certainly complicate things in spy novel, however, because, you know, in real life, there was a lot of people being forced to just stay home. They didn't even telework because, you know, they were very worried about the security of any, you know, channels they tried to set up. So that would be a pretty boring novel. But yeah, I mean, and that's like a perennial question, I think, with spy thrillers. How technical and detailed you want it to be, because you lose a lot of readers if you just get too bogged down in the weeds, you know, not only of technology, but even of the, you know, the various political situations you might be trying to, you know, trying to cover in your book. For instance, I think there's a fascinating story yet to be told with what happened with disinformation, but it's a very complicated story. And I think a lot of people just kind of tune out after the first, you know, couple steps.
Yeah, and I don't think that story's over. I don't think that's done. I think it's still going on, and it's still something to be worried about.
Oh, absolutely. And it's morphed in ways, too, that if you were only familiar with what the early discoveries were, you might be surprised at how sophisticated it's become.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Yeah, why? Well, I wouldn't be surprised, actually. The stories I hear every day make me... No, I wouldn't be surprised. When you say deep research, where what does that mean to you, and how long does that take you?
Well, I shouldn't joke. I mean, so with the historical horrors, there's a lot of research. For instance, the Deep, which was about the Titanic, was huge. I mean, there were 2,300 passenger and crew on the book, and I actually read a thumbnail bio for each and every one of them in order to make a determination, like, you know, which characters, like people I wanted to pull in to become characters in the book, you know. And I go through, make very detailed timelines and all kinds of stuff, but I do them kind of quick. And this is what really shocks people, because I was a research analyst basically for 30 years. So you get very comfortable doing research, even for, you know, really big projects. So it doesn't daunt me too much, but I have to say, you know, people have asked me, was Red Widow hard to write? And the answer is hell no, because you know, I just spent 30 years doing this. It was actually kind of easy and fun compared to the Titanic. So, you know, when I came up with the plot points, it was like, okay, I know exactly in this situation, this is what the options would be, and I'm going to choose this option. So for the next book, I'm getting a little bit deeper into the oligarch story, and that's not one that I'm super familiar with. So I'm having to do a bit more research than lazy me did. So that's, I'm kind of joking. It's just like three books, right? I just spent the morning reading a bunch of articles to get an idea of like which books I wanted to use for deeper dives. And lazy me is going to have to read three books. Yeah.
Oh, no. Oh,
and maybe go to London. I haven't decided yet.
That's a tough one. Yeah. Hey, so what, when someone picks up Red Widow and they take it home and read it, at the end of the book, what is it you want them to take away from it?
I want them to understand that the, you know, for everything they see in popular culture about the spy business, it actually is kind of a singular profession that has, you know, these challenges and kind of, you know, drawbacks that you may not really think about. You know, popular culture makes it look so glamorous and everything, but it's really tough, especially at CIA. You know, the business of CIA is human intelligence, and that means it's information that a human gets from another human. Like all the technical stuff is kind of more or less the purview of other agencies. You know, what CIA does is it finds individuals who has access to information that we need. And these case officers or operations officers convince them to give up that information. And what that means is those case officers are really good at manipulating other people. They are the best manipulators in the world. And while most of them are wonderful professionals who can control that, there's a small percentage of them kind of get lost, morally lost. And they will turn that on their coworkers, they'll turn it on their spouses, they'll turn it on their children, their neighbors. And, you know, almost everyone who works at CIA probably will experience it once in their career. I did, and I'm here to tell you, it's like being dropped in a shark tank. It is very bad and very scary. And when your management does nothing to help you, it's even worse. So, you know, that's just like one glimpse of the types of challenges that you face when you go into the profession. And so, like I said, though, you know, by and large, people in intelligence, you know, are extremely patriotic. They do this for the American people. They really don't do it for money. And, you know, and it is a fascinating job, and you get exposed. You get the opportunity to do things that you just can't imagine. Just can't imagine. It's amazing career field, but, you know, one that also takes a toll.
I just wanted to go back to horror for just one second, since you've written historical horror. You know, I came of age in the 80s during, you know, the first horror boom, where, you know, the market had imploded by 94. And I was just wondering, do you think horror fiction is making a comeback within the mainstream?
Oh, I definitely do. I think we're starting to kind of enter a new golden age of horror. And part of that is because what people perceive of it as horror has sort of broadened. There's a lot of what we call horror adjacent now, where you're getting stories that are, you know, they kind of sometimes straddle psychological suspense, you know, and have those horror elements. If you talk to the Horror Writers Association, they say that horror isn't a genre, it's a feeling. So any story that can kind of conjure up, make you have those feelings of dread, you know, could technically classify as horror. So, you know, you get, you know, these serial killer stories and all that kind of stuff. Last year or so, I was asked to read a lot of books for blurbs that some people probably wouldn't even think of as horror, but it was, you know, it might raise the possibility, is there a supernatural thing at play, or is it something, you know, that's much more human? It's almost always something much more human. I mean, humanity is the basis of most of our horrors.
Absolutely.
I'm so bleak, though.
Alma, do you think there's, you know, this is sort of more of a, I guess, craft question, but do you think there's a difference in the way that you structure a horror plot versus a thriller? Did you find a difference in your process or not? Did you feel they're sort of similar?
I think some people would tell you that I don't write thrillers because most people think of thrillers as having more of a breakneck pace, right? People just can't turn those pages fast enough. And I just, for the life of me, I just can't seem to do that. I'm much more of a slow boil person, and I'll read some reviews and some folks are just disgusted. You know, this was the slow boil. Kind of hard to build suspense if you don't, you know.
Turn right.
Yeah. So, but there are some horror writers that write great thrillers. Christopher Golden, his books are definitely thrillers and they're definitely horror.
How do you find your voice then when you write?
I'm sorry. What was the question?
Oh, breakup. I was just going to say, how do you find your own voice when you write the story?
Isn't that, I mean, that's, sometimes I, you know, and a lot of writers probably feel this way. We go along all smug and happy and we think, I got a good voice. And then you read something that just makes you realize, oh, crap, you know, I could do a lot better than this. Sorry. Damn technology. So, you know, I try to have it really come from the characters. I really do try to write character-driven fiction. But, I mean, I notice it, too, in some of my books, the voice might become a little redundant. For the historical ones, it probably has to do with the historical aspect, though, you know, that I try to make it a little more formal, because generally in the periods that I've written in so far, you know, when people express themselves, it did tend to be a little bit more formal than maybe how we express ourselves today.
Yeah. It's interesting. How did you pick like the Japanese internment, and what makes you choose a subject to actually go into a book?
Well, part of it comes down to discussions with the publisher. You know, after The Hunger, which is a reimagining of the story of the Donner Party, which is just a fascinating story. But, you know, we were very lucky that book did very, very well. And so, then the question was, okay, what big disaster are you going to write about next? And that really, that hadn't been my intention. So, you know, when you start, you know, flailing around looking at disasters, oh, that one's not big enough, or, you know, this one's in the wrong part of the world, because, you know, it has to be things that you think readers will want to read about. So the Titanic was like a natural. And when I found out that there was a second ship, a sister ship, another ship of the line that also sank, and that there was one woman who survived both of them, like I knew that was the basis, right? That was a no-brainer. There's got to be a story there. But for the next one, it this is, you know, some people might not like hearing this, but it kind of happened because you know, publishers were saying that books that were too historical, you know, were losing audience, and that the most popular books were either, you know, like the 20th century or the 20th century. So I started thinking about, you know, that time frame. I had just done one that was sort of based around World War One. So, you know, I'd always been interested in the internment. Like I said, when you have family and friends who went through it, you know, maybe you see signs of it that the average person who only knows about it from what they learned in history books doesn't see. And, you know, like all my historical horrors, they're meant to sort of show that we're going through it again, right? The bad things aren't just something that happened in the past, but a lot of times we're reliving those same things, maybe because we didn't learn the lesson the first time. So if you look at what happened in the internment, I mean, it doesn't take a huge leap of imagination to see that we're seeing another resurgence of nationalism and the sort of fear of the other and, you know, a lot of the bad things that we wish were sort of in America's past.
Mm. So when you write about the internment and stuff, how do you pick, like, do you actually find people that were involved in it and go through their story and put it into the book, or is it something completely fictional?
Well, one thing I learned, or that's evolved over time, you know, like with the Hunger, the Donner Party, I stayed very close to the history. So the vast majority of the characters were actual people in the Wagon Party. And then when I was doing the Deep, I kind of realized that, you know, I felt a little bad for putting some of those real people through some of the things that you just need to have in order to create conflict and, you know, to set up the story that you want in fiction. So now for The Fervor, I think there's one or two real life characters. All the rest of it, it's a completely, the story's been completely fictionalized. I just feel more comfortable with that now. It'll be interesting to see how readers react to it. But, you know, all of the underlying stuff is, you know, is taken from history. It's taken from stories that I heard from family members, from the things that I've read. One, I really lucked into something. One of my neighbors, her family had all been interned at Minidoka in Idaho, and they kept everything. So she had this treasure trove of documentation, you know, yearbooks from the school, and I'm using air quotes here, at Minidoka, and mimeos of, you know, the internal newspaper that they, you know, all kinds of stuff that you just couldn't get your hands on, that she lent to me while I was doing the research for the book.
That was pretty lucky then.
Very lucky, and I hated to give them back to her.
Well, move away. She'll never find you.
We did move away, but
change your name, right?
Yeah, I know.
I mean, is that even your real name?
Yeah, it is. I would have made up a much easier name. Spell and pronounce.
Well, yeah, you know. So when things are going on, like in the world that have been going on, do you think it seeps into your writing when you get into horror and even the Red Widow and stuff, you know, with the pandemic and Black Lives Matters and Trump and all the unrest the last 4 or 5 years, does that kind of seep into your writing? Do you think you get a little bit darker with it?
You know, I think that's inevitable. It was interesting in The Hunger that was written during the 2016 presidential campaign. And, you know, after I'd handed it in, my editor said, you know, people here in the house who've been reading it have said that, you know, they just see these like little wisps of what's going on. And I felt bad about it at first. You know, you don't want to project into a historical event. But then when I did research about like what were the biggest issues of the time, you know, that's where I found that mirroring, that's a hard word to say, you know, what was going on with Manifest Destiny, you know, the fact that they were just, American settlers felt that they were totally within their rights to march across land and, you know, settle on land that belonged to Native Americans and that belonged to Mexicans, you know, some of it was, that's the whole reason the disaster happened, actually, was because they believed this lawyer with political aspirations who was trying to get America to seize California, is kind of the same way they ended up getting Texas. And, you know, he wrote that he had this cutoff that would take them magically to California. And so he was trying to drive Americans to California. I mean, like the mirrors to what was happening in the country at the time just smacked me between the eyes. And then I realized, oh, let's do this the easy way. Let's identify the issues that were going on at the time of the event and then, you know, shape the theme of the book around that. And so that's how the Deep, you know, is about it, huge class disparity, because that's what was going on at the end of the Gilded Age, and women's rights. Women still didn't have the right to vote in America or the UK. So yeah, I'm having a field day with internment of the Japanese during World War II.
Oh yeah, it's just amazing. And I think a lot of people don't really understand what the history was. Enough time has passed where a lot of the younger generation probably don't realize that it even existed.
I mean, a lot of it, ostensibly, you know, there's the war threat, but when you talk to the people who lived through it, a lot of it was economically driven. It was this, the fear of Asians. I mean, there was a lot of restrictions on their ability to immigrate to the country still. At that point, there was a fair number of Asians, not just Japanese, on the West Coast, but there was this economic thing. You know, a lot of people I know lost everything, lost farms, lost land, houses that are worth a lot of money today, lost entire businesses, had, you know, left belongings with neighbors, and the neighbors turned around and sold it. You know, and reparations, there were reparations, I forget if that was in the 70s or the 80s, but it was a drop in the bucket compared to what was actually taken away from these people who were American citizens. I mean, not all of them, they were first generation, but a lot of them were American citizens.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty depressing, you know. Well, let's talk. You have a website or a place that people can come find you.
Yes, it's my name, omakatsubooks.com, because I lost omakatsu.com.
The real Omakatsu got that.
Yeah, the real Omakatsu. She still has that website.
Why don't you take her out? Just make a phone call. Isn't that like, you know, can't you just dial a number and say, hey, you know, take that person
out? Not just get your domain back. I'm finding that's trickier than you might think. Yeah.
Well, you know people. Come on.
Yeah, they don't know who they messed with when they started.
That's right. I'm just get on them, you know. Well, of course, we'll have that up on our website as well. And, you know, so anybody that has something they want to say, or if they want to send you some secret information, they can, you know, stuff like that. And
man, you're going to get me in trouble.
That's what I'm here for. That's what I do. That's what I do best. You know, it's funny because, you know, working in the in an intelligence agency for a long time, you must see a lot of negativity, you know, people that do a lot of bad things or hear about it. Did that change how you are with people? Do you trust people, or are you scared of them? Like, does it change you?
I'm not scared of them, probably because I live in America. And I'll explain that.
Because you have a gun.
No. Maybe I shouldn't say that. No. Living here in West Virginia, I might be the only person here without a gun.
No, me too. Me too.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, we live in this interesting pocket on a hill, in a couple hills in West Virginia. But no, when I said before that I work complex contingency operations, that means for a long time in my portfolio, it also included genocides and atrocities. Back in the 90s, which was like the big age of genocides and atrocities, you know, you'd wake up one morning and you'd find out that some people had slaughtered 10,000 people overnight. You know, like, just really makes you see the worst in people. And when you work those kinds of issues, you do go through like a depression for several years after it. So I've kind of come out of it now. But yeah, for a while, you know, I understood the worst that people were actually capable of. It's starting to fade a little bit from my mind. So yeah, it can be, you know, that's unfortunately, everybody who works in that field ends up having PTSD for a while, a couple of years afterwards.
Yeah, I noticed that because I've worked with a lot of cops and a lot of people through doing true crime and stuff like that. And, you know, if you're out for lunch, they're looking at everybody, like they're eyeing down the place. They've got two routes of escape. They've got, you know what I mean? It just comes natural.
Yeah, I would say I'm probably not as bad as that, but for a while it does make you, you know, like people would gripe about, you know, their crummy day. Oh, the waitress put the wrong condiments on my hamburger, and you know, I want to because, you know, is that the worst thing in your life right now? You're really lucky.
Yeah. Do you think people really be scared if they knew more about intelligence, what really went on?
I hope not scared. I mean, you know, there's a lot of checks and balances in the system. It's not like a bunch of crazy rogue people. And when I say I worked, you know, I was an analyst. We looked at genocides and mass atrocities that were taking place. Somebody asked me once, they thought I committed them. No, that is it's not what your government does, and really, really should stop, you know, reading those QAnon things. But
QAnon's not true.
Do not even get me started. It, you know, that's the scary thing, that there could be that many people in this country who,
Well, QAnon's going to be on the show. with Alex Jones, they're going to tell us about, you know, what's going on in the world.
You're having Alex Jones on your show?
No.
Thank God.
I had my run-in with him years ago, so he doesn't like me too much, but I'm small potatoes for him. He's got Bill Gates to deal with, so
right. And let's not forget that.
Yeah, no. Well, it's certainly been interesting. I really appreciate you coming on, and you know, you've done it all. I mean, what did we learn? We've learned about the Red Widow and CIA and how Alma wants to do some pot as soon as possible.
You know, maybe people start mailing that to me.
Yeah,
there you go.
go for it. You know, it's someplace. Mail it where it's legal. That's all I can say. If it's illegal, don't mail it. Okay, but it's been quite a bit. We've learned a lot, and
thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, and we wish you a lot of success, and hopefully, it goes well for you with these kind of CIA kind of books. It's a really interesting field, and you're going to be a TV star too.
Well, believe it or not, I'm an executive producer, and I know nothing about TV. So they're very kindly taking me by the hand and putting up with my stupid questions and everything. It's fascinating, though, getting to learn another business at this age. That's the part that I like. I'm sure you all feel the same way. It's getting to learn new things that kind of keep the job interesting.
Certainly is. And producing a film is pretty exciting, because it's really like witnessing it from the inside.
How the sausage is made, as they say.
Yeah, that's right. You get to see what's in the sausage, and sometimes that's not so pretty. But well, anyway, I appreciate it. Our guest has been Alma Katsu, and the book we're focusing on is Red Widow. It's in your bookstore today. It'll be up on the website. Thank you for being here.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Alma.
Thanks, Alma.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.